Hey friends, I'm Matika. I'm a photographer, a writer, a filmmaker. I'm a wife now and a mama. And I'm super happy to be here with all of you. So thanks for joining us again. Welcome back, Des.
It's been a while. Hey relatives, I'm Dr. Desi. I'm a professor, data warrior, relative, and mama, back on for another episode of All My Relations.
This week, we are jumping back into our Black Native series with a fabulous guest, Amber Starks.
Yes. Amber, aka Melanin Muskogee, is an Afro-Indigenous activist, organizer, cultural critic, decolonial theorist, and budding abolitionist. She's an enrolled citizen of the Muskogee Creek Nation. She's also of Shawnee, Uchi, Quapaw, and Cherokee descent. She earned a Bachelor's of Science with an emphasis in biology and anthropology from the University of Oregon. She's wicked talented. We're super grateful to have her on the pod. Let's go.
Sorry.
Thank you so much, Amber, for joining us today. We're so grateful to have you on and to be in this conversation with you. Let's just start by having you tell us a little about yourself, who you are, and the work that you do.
Thank you. Heche, Amber, Jehochef, Kados, Ishti, Muskogee, Ome. Hi, everyone. My name is Amber. I am Muskogee. I am also African-American, a very proud Black woman. And I guess, yeah, online I go by Melanin Muskogee, and a lot of the work I do is around Black indigeneity, affirming Black indigeneity, also speaking to Black liberation and indigenous sovereignty, and how those two, you know, movements have parallels and intersectionalities. And I really like to speak to the fact that, you know, Black and indigenous communities, you know, we have such potential for greatness if we can, you know, work through the lateral harm, work through, you know, the things that we've had to endure under settler colonialism and white supremacy. And, you know, again, I don't think that means that we have to turn a blind eye to the things that have happened between our communities. But I think that we should also contextualize it and understand that there's also horizontal oppression and horizontal violence that kind of instigate even a lot of the harm that we cause one another. So, you know, I think that the conversations I'm hoping to have online are centered around, you know, those issues and ways that we can build community and kinship between our communities and really focus on the goal for me, which I think is an actualized sovereign indigenous future and a actualized Black liberated future. That's what I do. I don't know if you can call it activism or whatever. I just care a lot about it. And I think, you know, carrying both Black and indigenous identities or ways of being, like, that's really important to me. So,
yeah, well, actually, that's a really good way to start. This podcast is dedicated to understanding indigenous relationality. And so we thought we would open this discussion by asking you what All My Relations means to you.
So All My Relations for me is rooted in kinship, right? I think as indigenous peoples, specifically, you know, in the context of the U.S. or the America, like what we say is the U.S., the Americas, Turtle Island, and this is pan-indigenous speak, you know, but I think kinship for us is an important part of understanding who we are and how we relate to one another and the land, the natural world, you know, our non-human relatives, understanding like our relationship to one another and how interconnected we are. And so when I think about All My Relations, that's what I think about is like, how do we build kinship and maintain kinship and, you know, make sure that that stays a goal in, you know, whatever futures we're trying to build, whatever communities we're trying to build. I guess I've never really thought about kinship that deeply until, you know, the last couple years. I feel like my frame around why that's important has definitely stretched. And I think that even, you know, being online and listening to other, you know, other relatives, understanding how like how being invested in kinship will help us to actually achieve like the sovereign future that we want as like Indigenous peoples. And I think that the same could be said about, you know, Black folks. Is like kinship is how we've survived under white supremacy, how we endured enslavement. For us, the plantation represented death, and in a lot of ways, the U.S. still represents the plantation for us. And how we survived is through kinship, is through supporting one another and caring for one another when we had nothing, right? When our Black bodies were commodified, I mean, and they still are to this day, but I think that we didn't see each other as commodity, you know, when we were on plantation. We saw each other as like, we need one another to survive. And so that's what, you know, when I think about all my relation, that's what I think about, is kinship and maintaining kinship and fighting for kinship, you know, valuing it enough to like want to fight for it. Mm.
Thinking about how we need each other to survive is so vital to our existence right now and to the kind of tensions that run very deep within our communities and between our communities. So much of your writing and activism center around how Black liberation and Indigenous sovereignty are complementary and not at odds. So could you share a bit about your perspective and experiences with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as a Black and Native person, like I've been taught under white supremacy that these two existences are at odds, right? That they are in competition.
Yeah.
And in competition for what is the question that I've continuously asked myself. And I think that thinking about like blood quantum and how blood quantum was an instrument and is still an instrument of genocide and how it's used to continuously erase. And I think, you know, speaking to the hyper invisibility of Native folks because of things like blood quantum. But then at the same time, we look at how Blackness was meant to be, using the one drop rule, creating more Black bodies, more Black, you know, individuals for the sake of using us, right? To commodify us, to exploit us. And that one drop rule meant that I wasn't worthy of multidimensionality or complexity, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea that these two constructs were developed by white supremacy and settler colonialism under racial capitalism, right? How can we commodify and destroy land and commodify and destroy Black bodies, right? And so when we understand how these two systems that were meant to make Indigenous people hyper invisible and Black people hyper-visible, like, we can understand why these two movements are complementary, right? We can understand that there's intentionality behind this. And so for me, like, my body kind of represents those two struggles. You know, unfortunately, it does, right? Like, I'm racialized as a Black woman, and my indigeneity is often invisible to folks, right? And so there's this constant tension of me having to be like, I don't need to prove myself, and my Blackness doesn't destroy my indigeneity, and my indigeneity is not at odds with my Blackness, right? And so when I'm speaking to Blackness in the, you know, in the Indigenous community, I'm asking folks not to see it as me trying to choose a side, but to make my Blackness and my indigeneity equal. You know, me being a Black woman, speaking to Black issues, I'm also an Indigenous woman, you know, speaking to Indigenous issues. Like, these are, you know, I say there's nothing at odds in my blood about who I am. I don't choose blood quantum. I don't choose the one drop rule. I reject them. And I, like, I'm deserving of both of my heritages. And that is very important to me. And so when I'm speaking to these issues, I'm speaking as equally a Black woman and equally a Native woman, even if I'm just speaking to one of those issues at a time, right? So I think, again, like, for me, it's about contextualizing why, you know, why Black folks are meant to be hypervisible, right? For the commodifying of our body. And often, as, you know, our trauma as entertainment, you know, I think thinking about like Black Lives Matter and that movement and hearing people say, well, Native lives matter too. They absolutely do, but not in response to Black lives, right? It's not a competition. And if we understand that the intent for us to be in competition is rooted in white supremacy and settler colonialism, right? We are so blinded and stuck on, like, we need to compete in order to win. But, you know, that shouldn't be the goal, right? The goal should be about dismantling the systems that want to destroy both of our communities, right? That is what I'm hoping these conversations online have. And they're very hard conversations. I'll say that there are times where I'm about to push, you know, share, and I'm like, oof. Like, am I ready to do this? Because that's, again, that's work that my Black body and my Indigenous body and my Indigenous mind and my Indigenous and my Black mind are going to have to, like, navigate when I post, you know. You know, I want us to understand these movements are absolutely complementary and absolutely important to be seen as complementary. And it doesn't mean that we have to erase one another or erase our individual communities, because our communities are valid, you know, as standalones. But we have to understand how we were both constructed under these, you know, under this racial capitalism and settler colonialism and white supremacy.
Absolutely. And essentially we have this system of, you know, this country seeking to get the most out of Black peoples and erase the natives, all for the same purpose of furthering the settler colonial violence of the American state. So what strikes me as, you know, square in the face from your words just now is how you call for the dismantling of systems that want to destroy both of our communities, both Native communities and Black communities. And so I think that's the ultimate coalition building agenda that we need to be bridging right now. That's where the urgency has to come in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love to hear you talking about presenting myself as a whole person. I've often reflected on this idea. You know, I was really encouraged by my friend, Jessica Metcalf, Dr. Jessica Metcalf, who told me, I don't leave my Indianness at the door when I walk into an academic situation or a professional situation. I am who I am wherever I go, and all of my indigeneity comes with me. It's kind of like poking at this two-world concept, which is super destructive, because we can't strip ourselves of our identities when we go into different situations. And so I love this idea of wanting to be seen and wanting to feel like a whole person. And then when I think about feeling like a whole person, I think about feeling safe, right? And what would it mean for me to be safe in my body? And I can't help but, you know, like think about Ta-Nehisi Coates and safety of body and how my body has been politicized and how it's not safe to be in my body as an Indigenous woman.
Matika and I, we can't speak to the lived experiences of being Afro-Indigenous women and the layers of complexity that come with that. And so your work with Conscious Coils emerged as an effort to help kids feel safe in their identities and in their bodies. So can you tell us that origin story and how it relates to your work and your activism?
You know, honestly, I'm trying to think about like that moment where I was like, I'm going to do this. And it was, I was in a leadership training with the Urban League of Portland. And one of the things I remember is learning about the rates at which Indigenous kids and Black kids are overrepresented in the foster care system. And, you know, as an Indigenous person, I know the lengths at which our community has gone to make sure our kids, when taken from their homes, have access to culture, have access to who they are. And I wanted to do something like that for Black kids. That was the original intent of, before Conscious Coils was even, you know, conceived as an idea. You know, I reached out to the Department of Human Services and I was like, even if it's one kid every month, I want to like go into foster care, you know, foster homes and offer my, you know, my service to the family, but also just to be in relationship with kids. And I learned that it was actually, unless I had a cosmetology license, that I couldn't even like volunteer to like just do braids. I don't know, whether intentionally or unintentionally, there was something racist about the law that like required me to go through a full cosmetology program that marginalizes Black hair, especially in its natural state, if it's not, you know, chemically treated and straightened. And I thought, you know, braiding is a cultural thing that for me, in a lot of ways, is a resistance to, you know, the transatlantic slave trade, to, you know, the destruction of Black bodies. It's been a way that we as Black people have managed to, you know, feel beautiful. Like we use our hair is so very important to us. And the plethora of ways that we've managed to do it in spite of our bodies being policed. It's one of those things that I feel like we have, just, you know, defied the odds of like our oppression through our hair. And so, you know, I called the cosmetology board and I said, you know, there must be some exemption, a way around it. And I was told the only way around it is you have to change the law. And so I called my legislators and, you know, some others, you know, I did some research and I called my legislators and I was like, hey, you know, would you help me make a law that allows for Black folks to do each other's hair for just braiding and locking, and that we don't have to go through a full cosmetology program that's going to teach us about straight hair, you know, European hair? Because let's be honest, the books, if you look at a lot of the cosmetology books, there may be one chapter, and that chapter might be 3 or 4 pages about braiding, locking, twisting, traditional African and African-American hairstyling. They do have a separate book, which to me is still like problematic. Like, here's this separate book. If you want to go and it's a specialty, go learn on your own. And for me, that represents like our culture. Like, here's a book about our culture, right? And we're not going to necessarily teach you this. You can go find it out for yourself. And so I'm like, but Black folks grow up, you know, a lot of us grow up knowing how to braid and lock and twist and things like that. So as I was working on it with my legislators, you know, the community really came out and was like, we want to support. We love what you're doing. Can we help? And again, this is one of those things about kinship, right, where folks related to it and was like, I know this story and I do my friend's hair and I do my sister's hair and I do, you know, I braid on the side. And so all that grew out of like understanding how important kinship and relationship is, even thinking about that through an Indigenous lens, right? Like I was like, this is important to me also as a Black woman that Black children have access to this. And in the midst of all that, people were asking, do you have a salon? And I was like, absolutely not. That's not my intent. But people kept asking, and I felt like it was just maybe the ancestors being like, you need to go this way. And I, you know, I've never ran a salon. I don't, you know, and to be honest, I know this sounds weird, but I don't necessarily see myself as a hairstylist. Like, the salon is a place where we do work. The salon is a place where we have, you know, like we talk about the realities of being Black in our jobs and our everyday life. It's a place of freedom. You know, it's a, you know, I use the analogy of like, you know, the U.S. is like the plantation, or like these structures represent the plantation. And the salon represents a maroon space, a free space, a place where Black folks can run away from the plantation and be free, right? Like where we affirm our bodies and we affirm our hair and we affirm our existence. And we understand that we exist outside of white supremacy, that who we are, our true authentic selves are not anything that white supremacy could even dream up, right? And in the salon, we defy white supremacy. In the salon, we celebrate our brilliance and our beauty. And I get to do kids' hair, and they get to see grown folks, you know, still navigating that stuff, right? Like, we haven't necessarily arrived as grown Black folks. And so we need each other to, like, talk about the stuff that we're really going through. And it's not just my clients. Me, too. Like, I'm vulnerable with my clients. And we build relationship. And so I call my clients my client friends, right? Because we have relationship. And so the salon is more than just hair for me. It's a place of liberation. It's a place of refuge. It's a place of celebrating our identities and existing outside of white supremacy.
Amber, can we jump back in and you can tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your upbringing, where you call home now?
Yeah, I was born in L.A. on Tongva land, and I lived there till I was about 10. And then we moved to Portland, and Portland is Clackamas, Cowlitz, and Kalapuya land. And so I've been here most of my adult life. But my family, actually, my mom and my grandma live in Oklahoma, just outside of Okmulgee. And I try to get down there once a year. My grandma still lives on our family's allotment from like three generations ago. And it's pretty amazing to go there. I went there for the first time when I was 18. And so, like, I grew up knowing I was Muskogee. And my dad used to say Creek, we're Creek. But I didn't really know what that meant, right? I mean, I grew up around my Black family and around Black folks. And, you know, when I would say that I was Creek, it would kind of be like, I'm Creek? You know, like that kind of inflection of like, I think I am. I don't know. I don't know what that means because I was disconnected from community. But it's so funny because Oklahoma always represented the kind of like this like mysterious like, ooh, Oklahoma, because my dad would go every year and it's like, it's Oklahoma. But that still is in me. You know, when I go to Oklahoma, I'm like, oh, Oklahoma, you know, this is that place that, you know, I longed for as a kid and didn't, you know, because of money or whatever, like getting five kids to Oklahoma was like expensive. So but now as an adult, it's like every year I go and I take my daughter and I don't want her to grow up wondering like if it's OK for her to exist as both Black and Indigenous. Right. I refuse. Like I want, and not that my parents did that intentionally. Like I don't think so. I think my dad and my mom did what they could to make sure that I understood, you know, like that I was Black and Native to the extent that they could, you know. And I always tell people about these, like, cheesy, like, you know those velvet paintings from, like, the 70s? So my mom bought us, my dad, I think she bought it for all of us, but these big, like, 6-foot, like, paintings. There's, like, you know, a Native dude, like, praying, and there's, like, a there's, like, a cow skull in the corner, and it's, like, I remember just being, like, oh, like, no one can come over here. But now that I'm older, like, I'm, like, oh, that was my mom's way of being, like, I see you. Like, she didn't, you know, she was trying. Like, there was also another little one of, like, a guy on a horse, and the horse was like, you know, bucked up.
Yes.
And there's like a moon. Yeah, we've all seen it in some shape or form. But, you know, they were like horrid to me as a kid, and my mom still has them. And I think like that was her way of being like, I see you. Like, I celebrate your indigeneity. And, you know, she was always excited for us. And the more I learned about my own family and I share with her, she roots for me to, like, thrive in both Blackness and indigeneity. And so that was her way as a little kid of, like, trying, you know, as horrid as it was back then. I just like, no one's ever coming over here.
This is so great. You know, you brought up your daughter and we are all mothers. You have a 4-year-old, I understand. I have a 4-year-old. Matika has a 1-year-old. And so thinking about this future that we want for our children is like the biggest thing we can do, right? I mean, if not for them, then what are we doing? And as I was recalling what you said earlier about how the racialization of Indigenous peoples and Black peoples really is rooted in the foundation of white supremacy. And, you know, but our babies are the resistance. And so I'm a demographer. I work with population data and numbers. And in 2012, the first cohort of majority non-white babies was born in the United States since invasion, right? Because we know prior to invasion, we were all Indigenous. There were only Indigenous babies being born here. But since invasion, that 2012 date is really important. And so what that means, right, is that the resistance now of Black and brown babies and of our bodies and of these future generations is like never more apparent than right now. And the future of this country is not white. Like that is something that everybody has to accept, regardless of who you are, where you come from. The future of this country is not white. Mm-hmm. And Native peoples will tell you, like, of course it's not white. The future of this country of Indigenous lands is Indigenous, right? That cannot be overstated. And so I want to know from your perspective, Amber, what is this kind of future that you foresee for your child and, you know, for your daughter, you know, your Black Indigenous daughter? What does that look like?
You know, every day I drop her off at school, I say, you know, remember who you are. You are Black. You are Muscogee Creek. And you are Jamaican, because her dad is Jamaican. And I tell her every single day I drop her off, because I want her to understand that no matter what the future brings, no matter what happens, no matter how people racialize her or, you know, try to force her into some kind of identity, that she remembers that at the core, that's who she is. And so my hope is that in the future, whiteness would be deconstructed as a political identity that is based in supremacy, right? James Baldwin talks about how before whiteness was a thing, you know, people who carry the currency of whiteness had their own indigeneity, right, in their home countries, and that in moving to the U.S., in order to participate in the racial capitalism, they were forced to forfeit their authentic selves, right? And I think finding authentic self is really important for all of us, right? Knowing authentic self. And so I'm hoping that the future will allow for people to be their authentic selves, and that we will be able to dismantle and deconstruct this hierarchy, this racial capitalist hierarchy. I'm hoping that in the future that there will be a sovereign future for Indigenous folks where we get to re-steward the lands of our ancestors, that we will get to have a say in what's best for us, right? That we have, that our sovereignty will be realized. And the same for Black folks, that we as stolen, displaced Indigenous peoples, right? Like, we are the descendants of Indigenous peoples from Africa, that our liberation will be realized. And I think that it doesn't, there are some times where I feel like we are so focused on what pre-contact looked like that we don't see ourselves as cultures that are able to change and adapt and still remain who we are, right? And so I'm hoping that in the future, even though it might not look like pre-contact, which I don't think many of us know even what that was or what that is, but that it's okay that who we are right now is sufficient, right? We don't have to look exactly like what was before. We don't have to be fantasies of what we think, you know, pre-contact look like. We get to have a future that we're choosing for ourselves because we're Indigenous right now in our bodies, how we look, how we operate, even with our iPhones, even with, you know, all the tech. We're still Indigenous. And the idea that we have to, like, go back to what it was before, like some idea, we can still have our cultures, our customs, our foods, our languages, and be Indigenous however that is now and in the future. So I'm hoping that our future is not something we manufactured out of fantasy, but that we are okay with, like, however we are adapting to the lives, you know, to however life is, whatever life is going to be like for us. So, I mean, that question is a little tough for me because I'm not sure what the future will be, but I'm hoping that it will be one that's liberated, right? It's one that Indigenous people will get to exist as Indigenous however we see fit for ourselves, right? And I want that for my daughter, for her to be able to exist in a Black and Indigenous body and that be sufficient. She doesn't have to worry about if people are going to question her identity, question her the validity of who she is, right? And in that whiteness as a supremacist construct will not exist.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big statement you made there, because that means we're imagining a safe world.
Yes.
We're trying to imagine an otherwise that includes an Indigenous future that isn't rooted in an extinction narrative and that isn't rooted in a pre-1900 context, that technology and contemporary life is just as Indigenous as going to a longhouse and wearing regalia, and that I can do both and still be exactly who I am.
100.
Mm-hmm. So, Amber, let's switch gears here. Your pseudonym is Melanin Muskogee. And for a long time, I remember reading and following your posts, but not actually knowing who was behind them. And I'm guessing it's because the internet can be a rather violent place, but I'm super interested in that pseudonym and your journey with your social media presence and how you are thinking about this work, why it's important, and how you hope it shapes popular consciousness.
So, yeah, Melanin Muskogee originally was me trying to be discreet and just maybe hide a little bit, to be honest, because I agree. I think in a lot of ways I worried about my safety, and I still do, to be honest. I still do. And I think it was a way to learn from other, from my Muskogee community as well, right? Like, I wanted to maybe not hide my Blackness, but having an understanding that there is, that anti-Blackness exists, and not sure of how, if people would be willing to accept me or teach me, because, you know, I'm reconnecting. Even, you know, even though I knew I was Muskogee, you know, growing away, like being geographically separated from my community, you know, as an adult, now it's my responsibility to do that work, right? It's my responsibility to, if I say I'm Muskogee, that I be Muskogee, right? And so Melanin Muskogee was like, nobody's ever going to find, you know, especially if I spell it traditional Muskogee way, no one will ever find me except Muskogee people. And that was the point, is like, I just wanted to, you know, join groups and learn and, you know, like, take it all in. And there were a couple instances where I saw things that were anti-Black, and I couldn't be quiet because that's who I am. Like, if something's wrong, I'm like, oh, nobody's going to say something, I'm going to say something. And I think the first statement that I made was, Black natives are native. Like, that was my first kind of declaration of, like, no, you need to see me. Even though I'm hiding, even though my name is, like, you know, even though I'm using a pseudonym, you need to know that Black natives are native. And I think originally it was other Black natives who, like, saw things, that message or other messages like that, and then building community with other Black natives who weren't necessarily Muskogee. But my account was on private, and it was on private for a really long time. And I'm sure, I don't remember the other statement that I made. And I think, you know, someone said, can I screenshot it? And I said, sure. And, you know, lots of screenshots. And then all of a sudden, you know, one day I wake up and I have like 2,000 requests, and I'm like, I cannot sit here and go through every single one of these statements, you know, every one of these requests. Because I used to go through and look at people's pages and see if there was anti-Blackness on them. Because if it was, I'd be like, I'm not. Mm-mm. Or, you know, or if it just felt violent to, like, be in community with someone. And how you know that, I don't know. But there were definitely folks that I was like, you know. So I think that there came a point where I was like, well, if I'm going to be speaking and if I'm going to allow people to share, then, you know, I'm just going to have to come off private. And I had a friend who was like, you need to come off private. And I was just like, oh, it's so scary. The internet's so violent. You know, and I still feel that way. And I feel like, especially in the last month, I've really been navigating that. And there are definitely times where I want to delete my account. There's times where I'm just like, why am I putting myself through this? Like, is this necessary? I've probably said enough that even if I never said anything again, it's been said. And there are other people doing this, not just me. So, like, what's my responsibility to this? And to be honest, the thing that has kept me on is the community, the kinship, because I realize, like, when people are violent towards me and when I say something like that statement of I'm a citizen of the Muskogee Creek Nation, it's because there have been people for the last month who have been challenging outward, you know, just saying she's not even enrolled. Right.
Wow.
As though, like, enrollment is the only form of, like, Indigenous identity, right? But this is the thing that they will mostly use against Black natives, right? She's not even enrolled. She's not even a real native.
Ugh.
And so that was me declaring, like, you know, you're sitting here saying this about me, never having spoken to me, and my tribal citizenship card is in my pocket, literally. You're being anti-Black. Like, just say you don't like Black folks and move on, right? Just say you don't like Black natives. And so what I realized, though, is, like, making a statement like that is me not necessarily you know, getting into anything, bantering with them, but me declaring, you don't get to erase my body. You don't get to erase my existence. You don't get to, like, I have the right to my Indigenous identity, and you don't get to take that from me. So these declarations are me standing up for myself oftentimes. They're me standing up for other Black Natives. They're me wanting to affirm other Black Natives, right? And so it's really scary. You know, I think about, like, the harm that people might want to cause me because I'm a Black Native who's saying something and people are in community with me, right? So, yeah, you know, even thinking about that makes me like, ugh. Like,
right.
Thinking about the harm that, you know, people. And if you don't like me, that's one thing. Like, I think I even posted something one day, like, I'm okay with you if you don't like me, but do the work. Like, don't come after me. You need to be focused on the work, even if you don't like me for whatever reason. Maybe I said something that, like, rubbed you the wrong way. You know, don't use not liking me as a reason for you to get distracted, because we all have a responsibility to seeing, like, a liberated Black future and a sovereign Indigenous future. And so don't like me and move on, you know, unfollow. But I think that sometimes my Blackness is a threat for folks, and especially because we do have anti-Native Hoteps, anti-Native Afrocentrist folks who are stealing Native identity, right? They are participating in the erasure and the genocide of Indigenous people. And so because I'm a Black Native, and you also have this other group of folks who are doing this, it's like, she's really one of them. She's just covert. Like, she's, you know, pretending that she's Native, because really she's trying to, like, make Black people more important than Native people. And I mean, that's preposterous, being that I'm a Native woman. I definitely have spent the last couple of days, last month, I would say, like, really having to sit with, like, you know who you are. You absolutely have the right to your history, to your peoples, to your ancestors, both Black and Native.
Yes.
And, you know, no matter how much someone wants to slander me, no matter how much someone doesn't like me, I will always be Black and Native. That is not something that's negotiable. It's not something you can take from me. And I think that knowing has really, like, oh gosh, it has made me braver.
You know, what this really demonstrates to me is how distorted Indigenous kinship has become. You know, it's 2022 and where we're at, you know, in terms of how we relate as Indigenous peoples, it's devastating. It makes me sad because, you know, we have blood quantum and exclusivity and, you know, these boundaries that are policed of who belongs and who doesn't. But at the same time, we can see that there's resilience and there's resistance, and we're coming together in beautiful ways to support our relatives, regardless of how they may be racialized, regardless of how they may phenotypically present, regardless of whether they're excluded by different systems, even laterally, you know, even amongst our own. We are doing this to ourselves in lots of ways. And so I think the resistance is so powerful. And in my opinion, you know, even though I think this is quite a contested belief, I believe that this is the way we have to think and act for sustainable Indigenous futures. We really need to be thinking about inclusive ways of belonging and of, you know, expanding our understandings of who is our relative. And it's not just about, you know, who is Indigenous. We need to have those hard conversations, but we need to be having hard conversations within our tribes and within our communities.
Yes.
What does it mean to be Muscogee?
Yes.
To be Cheyenne? To be,
yes,
Diné? To be Comanche?
Yes.
You know, what does that actually mean?
Yes. And that will be different, right? Like, what being Muscogee means is different than being Diné, right? And this is what I try to speak to also, is that we as Indigenous people, we're going to have to do this hard work. This is the hard stuff that we're going to have to navigate. This is, you know, man, settler colonialism and white supremacy has done some real work, right? This, the whole, you know, proving indigeneity kind of things. I definitely feel sometimes like half of my friends are like, you know, half of my relatives are like, yes, I'm for it. And others are like, no, I'm not. And then I'm like, oh, you know, like, it, you know, you feel like you have to choose a side. And, you know, like I said, I'm kind of rooting myself in, you know, we're going to have to do this work. It's going to be hard. I'm not choosing a side. I'm choosing indigeneity. I'm choosing kinship. I'm choosing community. I'm choosing indigenous sovereignty and tribal sovereignty. That's what I'm choosing. And so whatever choice I make, it's rooted in that. Like, I'm not choosing people over other people. I'm choosing a sovereign indigenous future.
We are complex people. I always try to tell folks, you cannot essentialize indigeneity.
No.
You cannot essentialize indigenous peoples. You can't. You can't essentialize who we are. We are complex. We live in complex societies. We are allowed to be complex, damn it. And, you know, we engage in complex ways of making kin, keeping kin, breaking kin,
yes.
Right? It's complex. How many times can I say complex? but like at the end of the day, like what I try to keep in the back of my head is how will this debate shape the future of tribal populations, of tribal nations, not in our generation, not even in our kids' generations, right? But in all those generations that are yet to come, because we are here, we will always be here. And how are we being good ancestors, right? What are we doing now? In the conversations that we are having and in the policies that are being enacted and in the violence that is happening, like, you know, shame on us in a lot of ways. Shame on a lot of us. Like, this is not okay. And I think that that's going to shape so many generations to come. And I guess I just want to like leave it at, you know, where is the love? If there's any reason that we are still here as Indigenous peoples, it's because of love. Love from our ancestors, that as future ancestors, we have to be acting with that love as well. And it's a tough situation because, you know, as we've talked about in previous episodes of the pod, right, there's so much damage, there's so much trauma that we have to heal from. But to me, there's still love. To me, love will always remain.
And there's hope. Yeah. And we have to, I think, again, going back to that whole idea of like, you know, pre-contact, everything was all peachy and creamy. Like, we were human back then, too. We had our own struggles back then, too. And so I think that we don't need to glamorize, like, pre-contact. Like, we need to be okay with the fact that, you know, our ancestors were human and made mistakes and, you know, probably did some really bad things themselves. But that's not an excuse for our oppression, right? It's not an excuse for settler colonialism. Like, we're not owed these things. Like, this isn't our inheritance, you know, being colonized people, having our land stolen. Like, not at all. I just want us to give ourselves permission to be human and permission to humanize our ancestors and what may have happened before. We're still deserving of land back because, you know, we are the rightful stewards of these lands, right? And so I think, like you said, it's really messy right now because not only are we dealing with just our own humanity, we're dealing on top of that with the layers of oppression that come with it, the layers of like harm that we are carrying in our bodies from, you know, being people who have, you know, who have been, there's a colonial power that has tried to like colonize us and destroy our indigeneity and destroy who we are. But, you know, we are resilient. I don't want us to feel like we have to always, like we have to thrive in resilience because I think that takes away from our humanity, right? Like we are allowed to be like, dang, this is hard and I don't want to do it anymore. Like I'm not strong enough today and I don't care and I want to delete my account and I don't want to say anything else. You know, I want us to give ourselves a little bit more room to navigate these things that are really hard. And we've been doing such a fantastic job. Like it has been like rough, but we need to give ourselves credit for how far we've come. And where we're going, we've accomplished so much, right? Like, I'm here as a Black and Native woman being able to say, like, anti-Blackness is unacceptable. Like, my grandmother's generation, the generation before that, didn't get to speak to anti-Blackness the way I do, right? So we've come really far, right? And I think we should celebrate that stuff and celebrate those small victories. It's important.
This was a beautiful conversation. We're super grateful to have Amber on the show.
Yes.
And it really encourages us to be critical of the policies we live under and to hold each other accountable to combat anti-Blackness in our communities and to come together, right?
Yeah.
And this conversation is one that needs to continue if we are to actualize a safe world for Black and Indigenous peoples. So thank you, listeners, for being here with us and for being part of the conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amber, so much for your time. We are so thankful to be in community with you. We appreciate your work, your time, your story, everything that you do, your social media presence, just the continued work that you do to amplify the lived realities of Afro-Indigenous peoples, and to keep us all on our toes and to keep us thinking and to keep us, you know, engaging. This is work that we all have to be doing. Not just Afro-Indigenous people.
If you want to learn more about Amber's work, you can follow her on Instagram and Twitter at Melanin Muskogee. You can view her interviews and writings linked to those profiles, and you can visit her at the Conscious Coil Salon in Portland.
Woo! Go Portland!
Big thanks to the All My Relations team, Darian Camarillo for editing, Sierra Sana for original episode artwork, Jamie Marquez Bratcher for project management, Teo Shantz for all the things, executive editing, music production, and more. And special thanks to Lindsay Hightower for social media.
Yes, all the people. It takes a village, everyone. If you love this work, please consider becoming a patron on Patreon. Hit us up on Instagram at AMR Podcast. And exciting news, we're working on 2 new episodes and we really want to hear from you. So a couple of things, let us know about your thoughts on Land Back, and also let us know your thoughts about your experience in higher education as a Native person. The good, the bad, the ugly.
Go to allmyrelationspodcast.com, hit the contact page, and there you'll see a place to send us a voicemail. And you know, you can send us any kind of voicemail. You could talk about Land Back and you could talk about higher education, but if you have thoughts, you know, maybe we'll put them on air. I'm just saying, send us a voicemail. We want to hear from you.
All My Relations.